Wakey, wakey. Eggs and bakey.
It's time for an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boss says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice.
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwaveable macaroni and cheese dinner at a People Sold and on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories. That's a gluten. Fat. That's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Filled protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat back on the menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Good morning and welcome to an unbalanced breakfast on WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. We made it in here just in time.
Yeah, we had a crazy morning. Thank you to the Orange Line, which I did not Google ahead of time and is doing shuttles today. So if you need to go anywhere north of North Station, just keep that in mind.
Good to know. There's our PSA for you this morning.
Yes, that will take the place of the PSA today.
All right, so we're going to, still recovering from the last couple of weeks here with my sickness, but good to go now. And we're just going to jump right in. So joining us on the line, our first set of guests this morning are Rebecca and Rebecca from the Friedman Justice League. How are you guys doing this morning?
Doing well. We're delighted to be here.
Awesome. Delighted to have you on, and thank you for getting up and calling in nice and bright and early
nice
on a Saturday.
Pleasure.
So, just to start off, because many people may be wondering, especially if they don't go to Friedman, can you tell us what the Friedman Justice League is?
Sure. The Friedman Justice League is a student organization at the Friedman School that came out of a Tufts Daily article, actually, in 2010. For all of you writers out there trying to make an impact, it happened. The piece was actually called "The Friedman School is White as Wonder Bread."
Oh my goodness!
And it was pretty controversial. It made a splash, and it spurred the creation of the Friedman Justice League. So basically, the Friedman Justice League works to make our community more diverse, and seeks to find ways to allow Friedman to work on issues of discrimination and oppression in its teachings and research and programs. And we have sort of like a twofold approach, looking at ways to engage the student body with conversations and education and work in the community, as well as engaging with the Friedman administration to work on issues of recruitment of both students and faculty, and ways to make the community more inclusive.
So the article that was that written by an undergrad, or was that written by a student at Friedman?
It was written by a student at Friedman. Oh, okay. Who is actually now a PhD student, and freakishly, her name is also Rebecca.
Oh, wow, that's so funny. So there's another requirement to joining the Friedman Justice League, apparently. Interest in social justice,
yes.
And being named Rebecca.
Indeed. I actually changed my name to join the group.
And so how does it work? Can anybody join who has an interest in this, or how does it go?
Yeah, anyone can join, definitely. We basically just try to get new entry Friedman students to find out about the group, sign up for the email list, get onto the Facebook group, whatever it may be, and come to meetings and just work together so anyone can join. We even actually had some Friedman administrations who came to our meetings occasionally this year, which was really nice to have that perspective as well. So it's totally open for anyone who's interested.
Awesome. And so we're just about finished with the academic year for this year.
Crossed.
I know, crazy. So can you guys kind of recap what 2015, 2016 has been like for the club, some of the events that you guys have done and how it's gone?
Yeah, it's been an amazing year. The group has had a lot of sort of different, it's had an evolution over the last 5 or so years. And this year we've had kind of a breakthrough in being able to collaborate across levels of the student body and administration, and as well as working with other schools, including actually the ASME school in Medford. So it's been and several schools downtown. So it's been a really great year for us. It's kind of a laundry list, so we'll just give you a little smattering of some of the things that we've done to give you a sense of what we've been up to. We start off every year with a farm volunteer day. So we worked with a nonprofit out in Concord that donates all of the food that they grow on the farm. It's essentially a nonprofit model. And then this fall we had a really nice visiting retreat and have the opportunity to tie in some of our work with Dean Mozafarian's investigative working group process. So we essentially created our own vision of what we wanted the Friedman School to look like, which we had a really nice participation from the broader student body. We had 35 people sign on to that letter that eventually went into the Sprout, but also helped inform Dean Mozafarian's process for one of his working groups. We've had two film screenings. One was in Medford and one was downtown. We actually just this last week were able to get a commitment from the Friedman School to change Indigenous Peoples Day,
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. Which was really exciting. We're only the second campus to take that on. President Monaco has said that if he can see enough support from individual schools, he'll change it touch-wide, but he needs to see that demonstrated. So we're excited to be championing that, following the lead of the ASME campus, which was one of our big collaborative efforts this year. So that was exciting. Bev, do you want to continue?
Yeah, sure. So we also, as Beck was saying, did a lot of work internally at the school. So some of that stuff include the fact that a diversity task force has been implemented, and that was within the school administration with staff, faculty, and a couple students who are part of the Friedman Justice League are going to serve on that, and they're going to meet semi-regularly, and that'll be, you know, permanent fixture at the school to prioritize and think about and support diversity efforts at the school. So it's very exciting and a really big deal, because a longstanding goal of our group has been that the student passion and activity and effort is key and important, but there should also be, you know, partnership and effort within the school as well, something that's more longstanding that actually has a bit more clout, all that stuff. So that's very exciting, the diversity task force. We also worked with some faculty on curriculum recommendations to make their curriculum a bit more diverse and inclusive. And that is something that actually has been going on for a while. There was a directed study through the Friedman Justice League several years ago that did that kind of school-wide. And so it's kind of been a longstanding activity that we hop onto since then. So this year we worked with Diane McKay on her nutrition course in the undergrads, which was really nice, just kind of adding research that happens in more diverse communities. I mean, as we all know, nutrition just is really has a lot of cultural dimensions, has lots of different physiological dimensions, as well as physical activity, all that stuff. So, you know, making it a space where someone who comes from not, you know, a white American background feels like the curriculum's relevant to them was really exciting to help Diane work on. And there was actually a guest lecturer from a few Freedom and Justice League members in her course. We also did, as Beck mentioned, work on the strategic planning process at the Friedman School. There were probably 8 Friedman Justice League students who served on the different IWG, DWG, the investigative working group, and deliberative working group, the two phases of the planning process.
Mm-hmm.
And that was nice to be able to kind of think through together, you know, like, what do we want to make sure are in those conversations, and what resources do we want to kind of, you know, put into the appendixes and things like that. So that was really nice to kind of scheme about, and it was really rewarding for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess you can cut us off if we're going on for too long.
Yeah, yeah,
that's really interesting.
Yeah, we also, Dean Mozafarian asked us to help develop some funding campaign ideas for diversity inclusion related work, so
and
we helped them out with that.
Yeah, can you explain a little bit when you talk about diversity inclusion? So in Diane McKay's class, you were talking about making sure that the research that's included is inclusive, which I actually think is really interesting and important. And also, I mean, a lot of people don't think about it, but if you think about almost all nutrition science, if it's whether it's epidemiological or not, I mean, it usually takes place in men. If it's an RCT, it usually takes place in white men. And then if it's epidemiological, when you control for ethnicity, white is set as like the default control, and then you're comparing every other ethnicity to the risk ratio or whatever to white people. And so that's something where like you don't even think about it. It's so automatic, and it's just like one of those things where you know, it's just really interesting, like, why do we do that? Is that really, does that even make really a lot of sense anymore? And so I think that's really interesting. I wonder, could you talk a little bit about when you guys were part of the working groups and sort of the strategic planning working groups, like what were your main things that you were like, we want this to be part of the conversation?
Yeah, and actually, can you just take a step back too and kind of brief the audience on what the whole, that old broader vision was for the dean and why the IWGs were started?
Sure. So the dean is new at the school. I think he started last year, right?
Correct.
So I think the school just hadn't engaged in a strategic planning process for decades, I believe. So I think he came in and kind of wanted to take the opportunity to bring in multiple voices at the school and make a plan together, you know, set some short-term, long-term goals for the school and kind of be able to, you know, march forward in an effective and intentional way. So that was I think my impression of the main goal is just to have a strategic plan at the school. So it started at the very beginning of this year, and it was kind of a frenzy of a process. Beck actually served on the first part of it, which was a lot of investigation, gathering information, interviewing, you know, specialists in several different areas. So it could be like research, education, outreach, communication. Like, there are all these kind of broad categories that people were diving into. Transformative change, like, what's our, if the school was to radically change, what would that look like? So, you know, all these broad categories. And then I this semester served in the deliberative working groups, which were kind of taking the major conclusions from that formative research and trying to break it down to major goals, major objectives, some activities. And I think using the work of several groups who have done that, and again, these different kind of target areas, they'll create a strategic plan, which I think they're going to be talking about at a town hall in May 15th or something. I don't know. Do you guys remember the date on that?
Oh, yeah, May 10th.
May 10th, yeah. There you go. Yeah. So do you want to jump on and talk about what our goals were there?
Yeah. I'm not sure what we're talking about.
Okay. Well, did you, like, for the Freedmen Justice League, I think our goals were pretty broad. It was just making sure that, you know, the word diversity came up. Like, sometimes it just kind of gets blocked out of the conversation when there's so many other priorities, which is fair. But, you know, we just kind of wanted to make sure that we remember that the issues at the school that we study, nutrition, health disparities, all that stuff, it really is affecting disproportionately communities of color, low-income people, vulnerable communities. So that felt like it should, you know, it should be present in the strategic planning process, that kind of perspective. Who we affect, who we work with, who is on faculty and staff, all that stuff to just be represented. I think some people also we're thinking a lot about, you know, we want to do large scale, you know, major change, but maybe we should also have strong connections with communities and more like on the ground expertise as well with sort of smaller scale community work. Mm-hmm. But I would say that a lot of our priorities, because, you know, we didn't, it's not like we sent people into meetings. We're like, this is what you have to say.
Right.
Just, you know, just try to represent the things that are important to you. But, our biggest, I guess, priorities were summarized in our Sprout article, mm-hmm. Vision for a Just and Equitable Nutrition School. So we kind of, I think, collectively worked based off of those.
Great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know that you guys have, there's that article on the Sprout people should check out if they're interested. And then I know that Rebecca has also submitted an article on Indigenous Peoples Day that's coming out in the Sprout this weekend as well. So definitely make sure that you check out both of those articles.
Yeah, absolutely. And Indigenous Peoples Day at Freeman is such a new concept that we're really hoping to get more people to engage with that. And there's a lot of room for planning for celebrations in the fall too. So we'd be thrilled if people were interested in getting more involved.
Awesome. And so obviously it's been a packed year and you've done, you've gotten involved in so many different areas, especially directly so with this strategic planning process. I'm just kind of curious, generally how you see, because you said sometimes a conversation can get lost and people involved in all different aspects of food and nutrition and kind of have their heads down sometimes in terms of what they're working on themselves. So how do you feel like in terms of working with the school, the administration, students, how much recognition and support the group gets?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a really good point. You know, when, you know, we're focused on justice, diversity, all that kind of stuff in our club, but it's so important to remember that everyone has a thing that they're passionate about, and there's so many important themes in our field. It's such a diverse field. So, you know, that's like part of the landscape for sure. I think overall, in our experience, when these issues come up, there's been support, but sometimes it's just a matter of raising them in the first place, you know?
Right.
And
continuing to raise them. Sometimes, you know, everyone's got, exactly like you're saying, everyone's got their issue, but if you don't repeat yourself enough times, it can get washed away. So I think it's been nice to be there as a student presence over the last few years. Being really consistently focusing on these issues, I think we're one of the bigger student orgs out there, and having sort of really amazingly committed constituency in the student body, bringing up these issues often, I think has been really key too. And making sure that we're explicitly focusing on them, even in the working group process. We've had some scenarios where people say, oh yeah, we care about diversity, inclusion, justice, like duh. But I think that making sure we're really explicit about setting objectives and goals and plans on how to get to where we want to be is really vital as well.
Sure. And I think it definitely is an important presence. And do you think, because I know that you mentioned the Tufts Daily article that came out a few years ago, and sort of in the, outside of the Freedmen Justice League, do you think that, how do you feel about the opportunities to get involved in social justice issues that Freedmen currently offers? Do you think that there are some good ways, or do you think that people kind of have to work to find things in other schools?
That's a good question.
thank you. Other classes at Medford Gibbs, like there's a food justice course, but that's UEP. So how do you think Freedmen does in general?
I think that the school, it's not a strong suit of the school, and it's not that they're, it's not out of bad intention. It's, again, just that there are so many different focus areas with regards to nutrition. I think that we as a group have really filled in the gap in a lot of ways, building community partnerships and finding ways to help students plug in. For example, we, as a student group, used to lead a Chinatown tour in partnership with a couple of different groups, nonprofits based in Chinatown, focusing on some of the racist history of the neighborhood and how Chinatown got to be in the state it's in, and some of the issues of gentrification. And being Tufts on the downtown campus, we're a really huge presence there.
Right.
And in a lot of ways have led to those rises in land value. And that's something that we often are a little bit frustrated that gets overlooked. But again, the administration's really open to change. And this year, just an example of that is that we were able to get that tour integrated as a part of orientation. So instead of going to Medford, where a lot of Freedmen students honestly take one or two classes, we had that tour as a part of that the first week of school.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cool. And yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot with that question, because I share your point of view as well. And yeah, it's awesome that you guys have been able to make that sort of progress. And so in addition to sort of increasing diversity and awareness on campus, like you mentioned the Chinatown tour, are there other ways that the Freedmen Justice League engages with the community outside of Freedmen?
We have, actually this year we've had some really nice interactions with the outside community. For example, right now there's the Leia project going on, which I think, Beck, you're a little bit more savvy on. You've been working more closely on that project, if you want to speak to that.
Sure, yeah. A group of high schoolers approached one of our members saying that they're interested in having a panel of guest speakers talking about their experiences in nutrition. And so actually just, I think on Thursday, four of our group members went to this group of 20 or so high school students and talked about their experiences with nutrition and did a really interesting interactive game with them on talking about sugar and Coca-Cola's marketing in communities of color and how a lot of the stuff that seems like just, you know, the way consumerism is can actually be really harmful and disproportionately impact different communities. And that's been something we've been working on, is how we can work to bridge higher education, especially graduate education, with high schoolers, sort of building this, what we call a diversity pipeline of helping nutrition. As you mentioned, Catherine, nutrition maybe doesn't seem relevant to a lot of people, again, because it's often rooted in whiteness. So helping diversify the field by getting people interested at a young age.
Yeah.
So that was a really exciting part of the Leia project.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, well, just similarly on that note, you know, a lot of people just think that nutrition means being a dietitian.
Right.
The number is crazy, but I think like 2% of dietitians are people of color. It's like really a white field, white female field. So I think part of our goal is letting people know that it's a huge field. There's so much important and exciting work to be doing. And if we want to have a more colorful student body and we want a more colorful faculty, part of that charge is engaging with, you know, younger students of color and letting them know about this exciting field. So we have, where we can, have been like partnering and keeping our eyes out for career days at vocational high schools. Like I went to one at Madison Park. Mm-hmm. Recently, and yeah, there's been a few opportunities like that that have popped up that we're really, you know, keeping our eyes peeled for and trying to build connections with as a group.
That's great. That's really interesting. And I've been reading Mary Nessel's new book, Soda Politics, and she talks a lot about sort of the strategic marketing that big food companies use to specifically impact populations of color or underserved populations. And so it's really interesting that you're kind of bringing that up here, because that's, I mean, it's something I had never really thought about. And then all of a sudden was like, oh, this makes so much sense and it's such a big deal. And we don't know a lot about it. Like, I feel like even my experience in the Freedmen School, and Matt, I don't know, you probably have a little bit more social justice built into your curriculum, but that's something I really hadn't encountered before. So it's really neat that you guys have such a focus on things like that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
A lot of our work has been trying to embed some of that into the classroom as well. And because it can be something that we focus on nutrition content and some of the like the big picture things, but we don't actually focus on some of the stuff that's happening in reality all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think everyone's crossing their fingers for the big faculty hire that's happening. I think it's like 8 or 10 faculty are going to be hired in the next period. And as you're saying, there are so many issues that are fascinating and super important, but maybe the expertise isn't really here at Freedmen yet, so you don't pick it up in your classrooms as much. So yeah, there's lots of expertise in all these areas across the country. So we're hoping that a faculty member at the school who can provide a course could be hired.
Yeah, and that'd be so key especially for the policy concentration, which is the majority of the school, I think, right, is in policy, and apply
nutrition. Think it might
nutrition.
Work out that way.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing we've been really trying to focus on is how we can engage more with our direct community as a part of our curriculum. The Urban Planning School in Medford does a really good job of having this core model that's focused on engagement as a part of classrooms and building long-term partnerships over the years so that we're not actually being a draw on community members when we partner, but really working to create comprehensive projects. So that's been something we've been looking at as well, is finding ways for our coursework to be applied in a productive way for the community.
Cool. And so just a couple more questions for you guys. One is, it's interesting how, like we were talking about, trying to get it more ingrained in the curriculum at the school, but even without that, there do seem to be a lot of students who have this interest and passion in social justice issues and want to get involved. So I was kind of curious how, in terms of your own backgrounds, sort of what made you interested in this and why you got involved with the Freedmen Justice League?
I'll hop in. I definitely didn't have specific expertise in this area when I started at Freedmen, but I think one of the reasons that I have ended up in food policy is because, I mean, for so many of us, food is just such a broad lens and like a catch-all for so many different things we care about. I mean, Matt, for us, we're in the AFE program, which is agriculture, food, and the environment. And there we're exposed to issues of, you know, like ecology and agronomics and sustainability all the way to nutrition and policy and, you know, economic justice, and there's just so much in food. So I think it appeals to those of us who have these broad interests. And for me, a piece of that has always just been social justice. Like, is this a fair system? Does everyone have access? Is it discriminatory? Who's losing? Who's winning? That's just, you know, a key part of the picture in the way I've always conceptualized it. So I heard that this club existed and just wanted to check it out in my first year, and then kind of ended up getting pretty involved.
Yeah, I actually, when I was visiting the Freedmen School, the group essentially convinced me to come to the Freedmen School. They had an open house with all the student orgs, and I talked to the prior leader of the Freedmen Justice League about the work that the group was doing. And so in a way, I kind of mentally joined the group before I even committed to the school. I just, that was my background, is issues of justice in the food system, and to me that's kind of, I was expecting everyone to be coming to Freedmen with more of that focus, so it was really vital to why I came to the Freedmen School, that this kind of group exists and this kind of focus was at the Freedmen School.
Awesome. And should also at this point, I know I'm going to butcher the name of the award, but want to congratulate you both for both being recipients of the Honest Civicus Award through Freedmen.
Yeah, congratulations.
So congratulations on that. obviously, part of that primarily driven by some of the work that you've done through the Freedmen Justice League.
Right.
And obviously, that means that, like I said, we're coming to the end of this year now in our 10 years at the school. So can you talk about kind of what's next for the club, kind of where you envision it going, where you'd like it to go, and who will be taking over?
Sure. So Samantha Hoffler and Caitlin Joseph are the new co-chairs. Congratulations to them.
Hooray.
They are wonderful and are going to do a great job. two first-year policy students. Beck and I were talking about this. What do we see the future of the club being? And I think we were kind of thinking about how, as much as we're so engaged and we work so hard on this and have all these goals and visions and stuff, truly, like, we're graduating, you know, we're not going to work in this group. I mean, we can be support, like, as alumni, but for me, I think the most important goal is less on the outcome side and more of the process side. Like, it's really important to me that students continue to be involved so that it can be an active club and the work can evolve and that those links to the administration stay strong.
Mm-hmm.
I think another challenge sometimes with groups like this is you're so active for 2 years and then you're out. So the
right.
next group doesn't know all the work that's happened, doesn't know what those relationships are. It's continuity and institutional memory is like a crazy challenge with master's programs. I'm sure you've experienced that even with student council. It's just kind of a built-in challenge. So I think kind of more on the process side, I just want to hopefully have all those institutional pieces built in so that people can just keep on doing the work and working on whatever's most exciting for them, yeah, with the administration together.
Yeah, that sounds great.
It's very cool. But, awesome. So yeah, definitely looking forward to where this goes in the future. And thank you for all the work that you've done. And hopefully the year finishes up well for both you guys personally and also the club itself.
Yeah.
So thank you again. Thank you very much for calling in this morning, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is awesome. Is there anything else that you guys wanted to bring up before we let you go?
I think we covered it pretty well.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, cool. And so,
thanks, guys.
Thank you. And so people can check out, for more information, they can go to freedmanjusticeleagueblog.wordpress.com. Mm-hmm. Any other ways to contact you or, to get involved?
We have a Gmail account. They're welcome to email us, freedmanjusticeleague@gmail.com. We have a Facebook group where people post, relevant articles to justice in the food system. Very active membership there as well.
Neat.
Great. So yeah, any listeners looking for more information, definitely check that out.
Yeah.
And this has been great. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you for having
us. All right.
Thank you. Bye.
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 All right. So that was cool. This has been a very kind of social justice heavy past 2 weeks for the show.
Oh yeah. Nice. Well, that's great. Yeah, I know. Since I'm not here to nerd out.
I forgot to mention at the beginning. Thank you for Catherine is back after a 1 week layoff.
Yes, I am after 1 week. Partying in Orlando. Was that a wedding? yeah, that was really great. That's so interesting. And I feel like you could there's so many issues involved in that. As soon as you start to talk about it, you realize there's 100 questions that I have. So make sure that if you're interested at all, if you're a prospective student or just interested in food justice issues, make sure you check out their blog and their Facebook group, because it sounds like they are constantly updating. Mm-hmm. Which is great.
Very cool. All right, so let's jump into our song break.
Yeah.
So usually I defer to Catherine here.
Yeah.
And let her, but I'm going to be greedy because I'm really excited about a new song that came out this week, which is going to sound really lame given my age and status as a grad student, but...
Is it by Blink-182?
Blink-182,
yes. I said that as a joke. I literally said that as a joke. I was like, what's the dumbest band I can think of? Just kidding. I love Blink-182.
Were you aware that they were back?
Because no.
they're back. Without Tom. No Tom, but they do have Matt Skiba from Alkaline Trio, and they are going on tour this summer with A Day to Remember, and they'll be here as well with All Time Low. So very, very exciting show. Get in touch with your high school self. And this is a brand new single that they released this week called Bored to Death off their upcoming song, album, California. You're listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. All right, welcome back to welcome back to an unbalanced breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Again, you just heard Blink 182 with their brand new single "Bored to Death." That's off their upcoming album "California," and you can catch them on tour this summer with "A Day to Remember," and then either "All Time Low" or "All American Rejects," depending on where you are in the country.
All American Rejects.
Yep. All right, so now it is time for our second guest of the show, and
yes.
I'm going to throw it over to Catherine.
Yeah. The second guest of the show has been replaced by me trying to remember all the words to all the small things. No, I'm just kidding. It's not. So our second guest of the show is Dr. Grant Ritchie. He's a doctor of dental surgery, and he can correct me if that's not what DDS stands for. But he also is a world-renowned skeptic, and he hosts a podcast called The Prism Podcast, where what they do is investigate... They skeptically investigate topics in health and medicine and science. And so he's here to answer a lot of nutrition and dental related questions, as well as any random questions I can think of today. So, Grant, go ahead and introduce yourself, probably better than I introduced you.
I think you did a fine job.
Oh, thank you.
First off, thanks, Matt and Catherine, for having me on. You guys have a great show. Except for the last week, I haven't missed a single episode.
Oh, wow.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. But you're right. DDS does stand for Doctor of Dental Surgery,
mm-hmm.
although I really don't do much surgery. I think it's a holdover from the olden times. But I got my undergraduate degree at the University of Kansas in human biology and then went to dental school at the University of Oklahoma. And have been a practicing general dentist in a small town outside of Kansas City for coming up on 30 years now. So it's a great profession, and I enjoy it quite a bit.
That's great. So and you said, like, it's a holder from old school. So, like, old school when your dentist would also cut your hair, or
yes,
just...
Yes, oh, okay. Barber surgeon.
Exactly. The barber surgeon. I'm assuming you're not also a barber.
Yes, I'll still do a haircut every now and then.
Stay up on when someone's under.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about, I just want you to talk a little bit about, summarize your work as a skeptic. So I know that obviously you are a practicing dentist, but you also have this other podcast. And so we know there's a lot of misinformation in nutrition. Matt and I talk about that a lot. But what kind of misinformation do you look at, and what kind of misinformation happens in dentistry?
Yeah, I've been, I guess I could call myself a skeptic for quite a long time ago, since even college days, although I don't think I knew what that word meant. When I got out of dental school, I was really eager to stay up on all the current science, treat my patients the best with all the latest techniques, and do what was right. And at the time, that's right when a lot of questions about, for example, safety of silver amalgam fillings. They contain 50% mercury, roughly 50% mercury, 50% mm-hmm. silver. There's pushback from anti-fluoridationists for putting fluoride in the water and in toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were kind of the mainstays, you know, that I saw on a daily basis. And so I tried to stay up on that. And as I got into it, you just realized some of the really bogus claims that are made that really frighten the public and can do harm, because if, for example, fluoride is not used or taken out of the water, it can really have a pretty profound cost in pain, suffering, increase of tooth decay,
mm-hmm.
you know, all types of public health issues because of that. As I went into it further, then you start getting into some of the fringe woo stuff, the same thing you see in medicine, whether it's acupuncture, homeopathy. In dentistry, there's a big movement of cranial osteopathy, where dentists kind of take a chiropractic worldview of where they can manipulate the bones of your skull at the sutures, and by doing so, somehow impart health benefits to the patient. And that type of stuff is still out there, and it seems to be growing just right along with the alternative medicine movement in general medicine and in veterinary practice and in all areas of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So can you circle back to the beginning? So I know we learned about fluoride in nutrition biochem as well, because obviously fluoride is a micronutrient, but or a trace nutrient, but But can you talk a little bit about what is the deal with fillings and fluoride?
Well, it's much ado about nothing. For one thing, fluoride is been shown to be safe and effective and has been for well over 70 years. It's just like anything, the dose makes the poison. Sure, if you drink too much, you can have some untoward side effects. There are industrial fluoride papers out there that show fluoride toxicity at high amounts.
Mm-hmm.
In dentistry, if you get to, there are some areas of the country, for example, that have high levels of natural fluoride in their water. Mm-hmm. Eastern Colorado is a prime example. And people who are raised in that environment, they get a lot of fluoride, and they can get what's called dental fluorosis, where it's a cosmetic defect on the teeth that can cause some white spots and brown spots, and in higher doses it can be pretty unsightly. But for the most part, it doesn't really cause any illness, any problems whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really much ado about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The trend lately has been to move from the systemic effects of fluoride to topical.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's important, I think, to still maintain a fluoridated water supply. That way it is available to everyone, because a lot of times the demographic that needs the benefits of fluoride the most are those in lower socioeconomic status, that demographic, because mm-hmm. they don't have as much access to dental care. Typically, their diets are poor, so they do have a higher incidence of dental decay. So if a cheap and effective way of preventing that, especially in children, is available, then I think that's a very important benefit. With silver fillings, yes, amalgam does have mercury in it, and that mercury binds with the silver and other metals in the filling to harden, and that's what makes mm-hmm. it hard and durable.
Mm-hmm.
And over the life of that filling, trace amounts of mercury vapor do indeed off gas off of the filling. So
mm-hmm.
when a person who is really criticizing silver fillings because, oh, you've got this mercury burden and it's toxic and it causes MS and Alzheimer's, and if you Google it, they cause every malady known to mankind. That's really, again, the dose makes the poison. And there's been so much research that show that there's really no connection
mm-hmm.
between any chronic disease or acute disease and mercury in silver fillings.
Mm-hmm.
So they can take that little bit of information and extrapolate it and create quite a scare tactic approach, propaganda approach, that if you're not up on it, it can make a lot of sense.
Right, yeah. I mean, and it's hard too, because you're so right. I mean, we're all exposed to chemicals all the time. They're part of your, food is made of chemicals. Everything is made of chemicals. So it's so hard to make the leap from this isn't good for me in large doses to not then make the leap like this isn't good at all at any time. It can never be good. And so it's so easy to kind of get lost in that trap. And it's hard too if you, no matter what your expertise is, like if you have a particular field that you know a lot about, it doesn't translate into being able to understand other things a lot of times. And so I think people want to be able to make that mental leap. Like, well, I know a lot about one aspect of healthcare, maybe I will know I should just kind of have through osmosis learned a bunch of stuff about other areas.
No, you're exactly right.
So let's talk a little bit about tooth decay, because that's something that's really related to nutrition. When we take nutrition 101, one of the major things that we learn, I'm in our nutrition textbook, it says something like sugar has not been conclusively linked to hyperactivity in children. And it also, for whatever you want to say, it's like they're like it's not something that they believe at the time is like a cause, the major cause of something like diabetes, but they do say sugar, we know for sure sugar tooth decay.
Yep, had to memorize that for the final.
I know you had to memorize that for the final, and I think people, people have different opinions about that, and that's like a whole bag of things. But the one thing that you learn for sure in nutrition is tooth decay, sugar. It's no good. So what's the deal with sugar and tooth decay, and what's the worst, the absolute worst thing that you could eat for your teeth?
Great question. I'm glad that they teach you that great dental factoid, because you were saying that sugar wasn't a cause of diabetes. And I thought you were going to lead in and say that they taught you that sugar wasn't a cause of cavities. I guess if you really want to get pedantic, sugar doesn't cause cavities because it's the metabolism of the sugar by the bacteria on your teeth that cause the cavities, if you really want to get nerdy about it. But here's the deal with sugar. In order for a cavity to start, and I'm going to overgeneralize this, but I think it's an after generalization, is you have to have a susceptible tooth. You have to have bacteria, bacterial plaque, or a biofilm, as it's now more commonly called, and fermentable sugar. Usually in the American diet, or even worldwide, it's sucrose. And so the dietary sugar that we consume on a daily basis is then metabolized by a very complex colony of bacteria. Again, we used to call it plaque, which is just an oversimplification. You just imagine a couple of bacteria sitting on a tooth, and they eat sugar and poop out acid, and it dissolves a hole in your teeth. But the microbiome, the biofilm of the tooth and gum structure is very, very complicated, with dozens, if not hundreds, of different species of bacteria. They are highly organized. They communicate with each other. There are a handful of bacterial species that have been shown to really be the prime offenders in tooth decay, and also gum disease, different subset, but they're all there. But basically, the Streptococcus mutans is the FBI's number one wanted list. But it will metabolize fermentable sugars into a series of different acids. There are several different acids. And because that species and the biofilm can adhere pretty firmly to a tooth, then that acid can just sit there and gnaw away at your tooth. And so I mentioned that one aspect of that triad is a susceptible tooth.
Yeah.
And that is where fluoride and good home care and sealants, where we seal up the susceptible areas of the teeth with a resin to protect the tooth, is that helps reduce the susceptibility. It reduces the risk. So even if there is acid attack, maybe it won't do enough damage to cause a cavity. But the worst, I don't know if I could actually speak to what's the worst, but a general rule of thumb is its availability of the sugar and the time in contact with the tooth. So anything sticky, chewy, if you chew sugar gum all day, if you're chewing sticky candy that adheres to the teeth and just sits there all day long, then that just provides the bacteria with an endless food.
So all my favorite foods, basically. So Swedish fish and those lollipops that are half caramel, so they're like stuck to back of your teeth. All bad news.
I thought all nutrition grad students just ate baby carrots and kale.
That's all I'm willing. Yeah, no. Unfortunately,
that's all you did. But and that's also why drinking a pop, drinking Coca-Cola, drinking sports drinks, those have quite a bit of sugar and are acidic in their own right. But if you sip something all day long, which a lot of people do, then that's just an endless supply of fermentable carbohydrates.
So your best bet if you're going to be eating something sugary is to just get it over with. Eat it as fast as you can, and then maybe brush your teeth.
Candy bar, and swallow it down, and then rinse. Then, it's not great for you, and there are other issues.
There are definitely other problems. Yeah,
exactly. It's on your teeth for a little while, and then it's gone. So, it's time in contact with the tooth that really is the biggest variable.
So what can you tell us a little bit about, so what would be, are there any downsides to having like a diet soda or a seltzer water versus having a regular soda in terms of teeth health?
Yeah, there's a lot of downside to that. That's kind of a myth because, if we're conditioned to think, well, it's the sugar that causes the problem, so I will drink sugar-free pop or diet pop or whatever. That is good because you aren't getting the sugars, so that's on the plus side, but they are very acidic in their own right. Some colas, for example, have a pH less than 3, which is highly erosive to tooth enamel. You're getting into almost, not quite battery acid mm-hmm. acid pH, but mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting way, way up into the acidic range. And if you look on the ingredients label of a diet soda, for example, usually one of the top two, three, four ingredients is phosphoric acid mm-hmm. that they just add directly to the pop for, you know, tartness, flavor, whatever the reason they do it. So you do, it, it just bypasses the bacteria and just puts the acid directly on the teeth.
So drinking straight acid, not a strong choice. Okay.
You're cutting out the middleman.
Yeah, okay.
Sugar to bacteria to acid, you're just putting acid straight on there.
And is that true with like just seltzer water as well? I know at least in New England, Polar Seltzer is really big here. But drinking seltzer water has become kind of huge. Does that have downsides for...
It does. The April 2016 issue of the Journal of American Dental Association, there was a great survey of the pH of beverages in the U.S. And they, gosh, I can't remember how many, I think close to 400 beverages they analyzed.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from waters and sports drinks to colas, fruit juices, fruit drinks, everything. And out of the... I'll read it here. Out of the 379 beverages, 93% of them had pH of less than 4.0.
Hmm.
So from 3.0 pH to 4.0, which is fairly acidic, is considered erosive to enamel.
Mm-hmm.
Anything under 3.0 is highly erosive. So you're talking really damaging. Seltzer water, which you would think it would be pretty neutral, mm-hmm. falls in that 3 to 4 range of pH.
Huh.
So it is really pretty erosive to enamel. So
right.
over, if you sip that all day long, there could be some dental health ramifications.
So then, so I guess another question then, right, is so sugar and acid. So lemon water is a really big trend in nutrition. Would that also be a trend in nutrition, quote unquote? It's not a trend in nutrition. It's a trend. People like to say that it does all sorts of things. That it doesn't even make sense. But would that be bad for your teeth? So people who are doing that for, like, lemon water,
you
is
know,
citrus
I,
bad for your teeth?
Is that just squeezing a lemon into water?
I guess so. Like lemonade, I guess like sort of like a lemonade, but without the sugar and probably less lemon.
Okay. I would have to think that it just depends on the quantity and what the pH is. If you start... You know, some of the bottled waters, you know, Dasani or however you pronounce it, you think, okay, it's water. It's right around 7. It's neutral.
Right.
It has a pH of like 5.3 or 5.5, which is, you know, more acidic than I would have thought. It's not enough to really cause any damage.
Mm-hmm.
But if you add lemon, which is, you know, citric acid and some pretty acidic material, into water that might already be a little bit on the acidic side, it just depends on if it gets under that 4.0.
Okay.
That, you know, it's kind of an arbitrary cutoff, but if you get under that 4.0, then yeah, it could be every bit as damaging as any of those other ones.
So I want to talk briefly before we run out of time about kind of the paleo sort of trend. I don't know how to the idea that back in the day, like if you look at modern hunter-gatherer populations, or if you look at, you know, ancestral evidence on hunter-gatherers, that they, because of their diet, which didn't include any processed sugars or processed foods, they didn't struggle with any of the type of tooth decay that we see today. Is that true?
That, you know, in a way, that is true.
Mm-hmm.
If you do look at skulls from different cultures going back, and again, it's dependent upon the diet. They didn't have Twizzlers and Mountain Dew on the African savanna, but
mm-hmm.
In some areas, and so in those hunter-gatherer cultures that did primarily eat meat and whole grains and fruits and vegetables, they did have pretty darn good dental health.
Mm-hmm.
There are some examples of cultures, I want to say, in northern Africa that ate a lot of sticky fruits and berries. And they had a ton of cavities. And this goes back 15,000 years, I think, the research shows. And their teeth look just as bad as the teeth I see in my practice.
So that's so interesting.
So, yeah, they didn't have candy bars and you know, lemon water, but
right.
they were still eating sticky, sugary, you know, quote, natural foods, right. And they had decay too. So there's no that myth of the healthy savage or whatever that we all think that just because we ate what our ancestors eat that it was healthy. That's not necessarily true.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Everybody listening, definitely check out the Prism podcast. It's one of my favorite podcasts. And check out all of the other stuff that you guys have. And are you, I know that the co-host of the Prism podcast is presenting at Nexus, which is the Northeast Conference of Science and Skepticism, I want to say.
Yep, you're right.
So if you are around for that, that is in a couple weeks in New York City. Definitely check it out.
Check it out. And I'm presenting there as well. So.
Oh, you are. Okay. I didn't know if you were there too. Yes. Sorry. But anyway.
No, that's okay. They couldn't find anyone else. And so they had no other choice.
Well, thank you, Graham, for coming on the show so much. Is there anything you want to share with people about where they can reach you or anything you think they need to know?
No, I would encourage everyone to listen to the podcast, Prism Podcast, and it's on iTunes and follow us on Twitter. But Matt and Catherine, thanks so much for having me. It's been a fun time.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Yep, thank you very much.
All right, have a good weekend.
You guys have a great weekend too.
Bye.
All right, hold on. Before we do anything else, I got to do this.
All right.
I'm Simon Cowell for PETA. Far be it from me to be critical, but I find it really appalling that this year thousands of dogs will die of heat stroke inside parked cars. There, people thought that that little errand would only take a minute, or it wasn't that hot. But delays happen, and temperatures inside a car quickly rise in summer, even when the window's cracked. Never, ever leave your dog inside a parked car. Your dog idolizes you. In warm weather, keep him safe at home.
For more information, visit PETA.org.
All right, and let's see if we can end things with a call here real quick.
Yeah.
WMFO, hello, you are on the air.
Oh, hey.
Hello.
Too many cooks. Oh. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get on the air. This is Tom. I'm going to be sitting in with Mike, and I just wanted
so
to let
exciting.
You guys know I'm here.
Awesome.
Well, it's a preview for Mike on the Mic, which
exactly.
is up next, so definitely stick around and listen.
Everyone can stay tuned for that, which is coming
Thank
up at the top of the hour.
Yeah.
All right. So, do you want to fade out with Too Many Cooks or your song?
Oh yeah, let's fade out with my beautiful song, which is by the band Steamboats, and it is called Only My Hope. Check them out. They just released their first full length album, I think.
All right, and thank you for our guests for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We will be back same time next week with another guest.
Yes.
So. Stay tuned for that. Check us out on Facebook in the meantime and on SoundCloud. We will see you next week. Have a great weekend.
All right.